Lecture 6, Mahatma Gandhi, Personal and Political Freedom.
These last three lectures in our series on freedom all consider people of color, that is Mahatma Gandhi, Martin Luther King Jr., and Malcolm X, in that order, all view themselves as involved in both a personal and a political struggle against racial persecution and injustice. They're all men of this century who become leaders of movements to liberate the oppressed, and in this way they are unlike those that we've discussed thus far. As we've said, the earlier figures, with the exception of Emma Goldman, were philosophers and not activists, and although Goldman was an activist, she was never the leader of a movement. Gandhi, who we turn to now, calling this lecture Mahatma Gandhi, Personal and Political Freedom, Gandhi was not only one of the most original thinkers of our era, he was the leader of the Indian struggle for independence, for freedom, from British colonialism. This was the largest mass movement for national independence in history, and Gandhi's idea of freedom had a more direct impact on hundreds of millions of people than any other philosopher. In the very first lecture, at the beginning of this series, we introduced the ancient Indian concept of freedom, the Indian word for freedom being Swaraj. And we said then that the word had a dual meaning. The Indian word for freedom, Swaraj, on the one hand, could mean freedom as national independence. On the other hand, it could mean what the Indians called spiritual freedom, or a liberation from ignorance, from illusion, from fear. And we want to recall that classic story in the Upanishads of the man entering the darkened room, gradually perceiving with more light what the object in the corner was, and at the end being freed from fear. Now, Gandhi takes this idea of Swaraj from ancient India. The title of his first book, written in 1909, is Hind Swaraj. He interprets it for modern India in a dual sense. That is, on the one hand, freedom for Gandhi meant India's national independence from centuries of British rule. On the other hand, Swaraj meant a spiritual freedom, or a psychological and mental liberation from ignorance and especially from fear. Gandhi wrote this about his idea of freedom. To quote Gandhi, "The outward or political freedom that we shall attain will be in exact proportion to the inward or spiritual freedom that we may have grown to as a result of our personal search. If this is the correct view of freedom, as I believe it is, then our chief energy must be concentrated on achieving revolution from within, or freedom from fear." Now, this idea of freedom from fear was a key component of Gandhi's theory and of his appeal as leader of the Indian movement for independence. Its meaning, its nature, was described very well by one of Gandhi's close associates in the freedom movement, Jawaharlal Nehru. Nehru was 20 years younger than Gandhi, and after Gandhi's death, he became the first prime minister of India, serving from 1948 until Nehru's death in 1964. He knew, he understood Gandhi well, perhaps better than anybody else, and in his book, The Discovery of India, he conveys Gandhi's achievement remarkably well. First, in this book, Nehru relates the appalling state of India before Gandhi became leader of the independence movement in 1919. Nehru describes a country of nearly 400 millions reduced to a state of terrible poverty and tragic humiliation under the weight of British imperialism. A system of exploitation and rule, Nehru says, that had continued since the 18th century. After conveying the utter hopelessness of the people, Nehru then comes to the point of Gandhi's entry. The passage is so eloquent, so accurate, that I want to quote from Nehru at length. This is Nehru in The Discovery of India. And then Gandhi came. He was like a powerful current of fresh air that made us stretch ourselves and take deep breaths, like a beam of light that pierced the darkness and removed the scales from our eyes, like a whirlwind that upset many things, and most of all the working of people's minds. He didn't descend from the top. He seemed to emerge from the millions of India, speaking their language and incessantly drawing attention to them and their appalling condition. Get off the backs of these peasants and workers, he told us, all of you who live by their exploitation. Get rid of the system that produces this poverty and misery. Political freedom took new shape and acquired a new content. The essence of Gandhi's teaching was fearlessness and truth and action allied to these, always keeping the welfare of the masses in view. The great gift for an individual or a nation, so we had been told in our ancient books, was abhaya, that is, fearlessness. Not merely bodily courage, but the absence of fear from the mind. Janaka and Yajnavalka had said at the dawn of history that it was the function of the leaders of a people to make them fearless. But the dominant impulse in India under British rule was that of fear, pervasive. Oppressing, strangling fear. Fear of the British Army, the police, the widespread secret service. Fear of the official class. Fear of laws meant to suppress and of prison. Fear of the landlord's agent. Fear of the moneylender. Fear of unemployment and starvation, which were all on the threshold. It was against this all-pervading fear that Gandhi's quiet and determined voice was raised, "Be not afraid." Now, was it so simple as all that? Not quite. And yet fear builds its phantoms, which are more fearsome than reality itself. And reality, when calmly analyzed and its consequences willingly accepted, loses then much of its terror. So suddenly, as it were, that black pall of fear was lifted from the people's shoulders. Not wholly, of course, but to an amazing degree. As fear is close companion to falsehood, so truth follows fearlessness. A sea change was visible as the need for falsehood and furtive behavior lessened as we opposed the British. It was a psychological change, almost as if some expert in psychoanalytical methods had probed deep into the patient's past, found out the origins of his complexes, exposed them to his view, and thus rid him of that burden. There was that psychological reaction also, a feeling of shame at our long submission to an alien rule that had degraded and humiliated us, and a desire to submit no longer, whatever the consequences might be. In Nehru's estimate, therefore, Gandhi's achievement was to liberate India from fear of violence and oppression, which the domination of British rule had fomented. Gandhi had infused Indians and their struggle then with a new sense of self-esteem and self-respect. Here was a movement at last that humanized people rather than dehumanized them. Now, how did Gandhi achieve this as a leader? If we apply his concept of freedom to his own example, then his political achievement came from his personal or inward quest for liberation. That is, he was able to show others a path to freedom from fear because he had, as a result of his internal or psychological self-searching, gained insight into how fear may be overcome. In order to understand this interpretation of political freedom emerging from personal liberation, we need to examine Gandhi's life, his quest for personal freedom, and the way in which his life experience may be interpreted as a series of stages of psychological development, each stage giving him increased awareness of his situation as an Indian in a country that was dominated by foreign rule. In this sense, we can see Gandhi's life as a journey towards self-realization, a realization of freedom from fear and freedom for self-esteem. Mohandas Karamchand Gandhi was born on October 2, 1869, in Porbandar, Gujarat, the western part of India. His life and his thought, I think, may be examined in the context of phases, stages of development, or what we may call, following Eric Erickson's work on Gandhi, his classic work on Gandhi called Gandhi's Truth, Erickson talks about a series of identities. And we speak first of Gandhi's primary identity. His primary identity is this central core of values formed early in life as a result of influence from his region of birth, from his caste, and from his family. In terms of his region of birth, Porbandar, Gujarat, was a real backwater. It was not one of the great urban centers of India, like Madras and Calcutta and Bombay and Delhi. It was far out there and relatively untouched by British influence, although British influence in India at this point was everywhere in 1869. So when Gandhi is raised in Porbandar, Gujarat, he's raised with a strong family influence, and the influence from the religions of Hinduism and Jainism, especially from Hinduism, were strong. That family influence came especially from his mother. He says in his autobiography in the opening pages that his mother and not his father served as the model for his early development. He is shockingly, I think, in the first pages of his autobiography, disrespectful of his father, calling him an impatient individual given to angry outbursts, where his mother was a model of self-sacrifice, taking vows in order to purify herself, a devout Hindu who practiced what she preached. Gandhi was also a member of the Vaishya caste. In the caste hierarchy in India, there are very broadly the Brahmins on top, and then the Kshatriyas, or the political and warrior caste, and then the Vaishya, or the business caste. Gandhi is relatively low down in terms of his birth, and I think that is important in terms of his placement vis-a-vis the vast millions of Indian people. He understood peasants well, and he spoke their language because he was not of the upper castes. In all of these respects, his primary identity then formed as a result of being born where he was, being a member of the Vaishya caste, and being influenced so much by his mother rather than his father. These influences were important, but Gandhi in his autobiography says that there is still another factor that needs to be mentioned, and that is that he was, from his point of view, but his own words, an extremely fearful child. He was plagued with fears of ghosts and of snakes. He's married early on, at age 13, in a childhood marriage that he and his wife deplored. That is the whole institution of child marriages in India. But at age 13, he looked to his wife as a person of superior courage. She wasn't afraid of ghosts. She wasn't afraid of the dark. But he was haunted by these fears until adolescence. It was overcoming these fears, these very personal fears, afraid of the dark, that constituted for Gandhi an important element in his own achievement of freedom. Now, if the personal identity is the first that we look to, and in terms of a primary identity, the influences at this early phase, then the next identity that we talk about is what we call his emulative identity. And by emulative, we mean his desire to imitate or to emulate the British. British imperialism, as we said, had been around in India for some time. They had ruled India directly since 1858, following the Great Indian Mutiny. From 1858 until the British left in 1947, they imposed an extraordinary sovereignty over that country of 400 million people. Imagine an island on the other side of the world, 60 million people, ruling a vast subcontinent of India at this time of almost 400 million people. And it included, British India included not just India, as we know it today. It included India and Pakistan and Bangladesh and Burma and Sri Lanka. This whole area, this entire subcontinent of South Asia called British India. What an achievement that the British should have dominated this region of the world for so long. Gandhi attended a school near his home in Rajkot called Alfred High School. And in that school, there was a British headmaster. The lessons of that school were in English, and the purpose of the school was to instill British behavior. English classes, English master. His basic attitudes of admiration and anxiety toward the British were formed early on then in this high school period, and it was during that time that he developed his infatuation for the British and his desire to leave India to take a law degree in England. So from 1881 until 1886, he is in high school, and then in 1888, he leaves for London to take his degree in law, and his emulative attitude is consequent. Thomas Babington Macaulay, an influential English historian and legislator, declared that the goal of British rule in India must be, quote, to train a class of Indians who will be Indian in blood and color, but English in taste, in opinion, in morals, in intellect, and of course in manners. Gandhi, in his youth, pursued Macaulay's policy unquestioningly in his attempt to imitate British behavior and character. In one memorable chapter of his autobiography that he entitled, quote, Playing the English Gentleman, Gandhi appears as a law student in London, desperately trying to imitate British behavior down to the last manner and gesture. For almost 20 years as a student in London and then as a successful lawyer in South Africa, Gandhi measured himself and others by English standards. He remained not merely a loyal and obedient citizen of the empire, he remained an ardent devotee during these years of British rule, cooperating in every possible way with the imperial government in South Africa, even to the extent of serving in the military. He believed, as the British had taught, that not only their politics, but their morals were exemplary. Now, if Gandhi's life had ended in 1906, at the age of 37, when the emulative identity ended, or if it had continued on this same course of emulation, as a successful career in law, as a lawyer, then it's very unlikely that we'd be talking about Gandhi at all now, because he would probably have made a lot of money, as many Indians did in law, but he surely would never have become the Mahatma. Instead, at this point, in 1906, his life moved through a series of dramatic changes, moments of truth, we'll call them. And we'll discuss only three of them in the time that we have. In 1906, his response to the Zulu Rebellion in South Africa, which brought his first act of civil disobedience and the writing of his first book, Hind Swaraj. And then the second moment of truth, his response to the Amritsar Massacre in 1919. And then third, his Calcutta Fast in 1947, which occurred only 5 months before his death, and represents perhaps, I think, his finest hour. Now, the main point as we move to our first moment of truth in 1906 is that Gandhi's reactions to British imperialism were extreme. That is, from extreme Anglophilia to extreme Anglophobia. And as he moves from the identity phase of emulation to what we'll call the identity phase of exclusiveness or negation of British rule, he moves then from extreme adoration and emulation of the values of British civilization to extreme exclusion and rejection of British civilization. So after Gandhi had gone to South Africa to practice law among the Indian minority there, many of the Indians were indentured laborers, but some of them were rather wealthy merchants trying to make their way in South Africa, and they needed a lawyer. Gandhi first went to South Africa in 1893, not to protest grievances of Indians in South Africa, as he would later, but rather to make some money. And he felt that South Africa was an honest way to do it as an aspiring young lawyer. And so he goes to South Africa and practices law from 1893 until 1906. And during that time, he's a model of emulation. That is, when he does get to form some protest movement in South Africa for the Indians, it's still very much as a liberal. He forms his own political party before 1906 in South Africa, the Natal Indian Congress, and then he forms his own newspaper, gets his own newspaper going. He believes that to the extent that the Indians are discriminated against in South Africa, he can address these grievances by going to the courts and arguing in a kind of Millian way for South African Indian rights. So he is, until 1906, working within the system, believing in the law, taking his cue from British constitutionalism that if rights are to be achieved for Indians in South Africa, this can be done without civil disobedience by working within the system. In 1906, matters change, and the move from the emulative to the exclusive. In 1906, British rule in South Africa was resisted by the Zulus. Gandhi was then, as we said, 37 years old. He was practicing law in Johannesburg. And he was so eager to support the British against the Zulus that he not only joined the war effort, but he formed an Indian unit of the medical corps. The result, though, was not what he had anticipated. He expected that the British would prevail, but he didn't expect that he would witness a series of massacres or watch with horror expressions on the faces of British soldiers as they flogged and tortured the Zulus. 3,000 Zulus were killed in this war, and Gandhi insistently later on says this was not a war, but a massacre. But it was not just the killing that shattered Gandhi's consciousness. It was the twisted expression, as he relates it in his autobiography, the undisguised brutality on the English face of violence as they used and abused the Zulus. That's what repulsed him so much, because he had been struggling so avidly to become one of them, like them. So he stepped back in horror. But along with that came understanding. The sort of insight that Gandhi gained at this critical moment in his development is interpreted well, I think, by Eric Erickson in the book that I mentioned before, Gandhi's Truth. The experience Erickson observes of witnessing the outrages perpetrated on black bodies by white he-men aroused in Gandhi both a deeper identification with the maltreated and a stronger aversion against all male sadism, including such sexual sadism as he had probably felt from childhood on to be part of all exploitation of women by men. I think this is a profound insight, Erickson. The insights gained by Gandhi, though, from the Zulu massacre, mark a critical turning point in his life. The first time, but not the last, that an act of mass violence would force him to discover a side of himself that he found intolerable and so rejected. The killing and the torment of the Zulus revealed to him not only the tormentor's real identity, but the dynamics of domination. That is, the connections, as Erickson observes, among various types of exploitation. Imperialist exploitation, to be sure, but also racist and sexist. Gandhi saw how this was rooted in the rule and character of British dominion in South Africa, and a month after the Zulu massacre, he began civil disobedience against the government. A campaign that anticipated in the next decade his nonviolent resistance to the British government in India. So after 1906, Gandhi turns against the British. And when he does, it is with a vengeance, because his masters have so thoroughly betrayed him. Indeed, his reversal is so extreme that he now moves to a kind of separatism that's as exclusivist in type as the English imperialists practice themselves. The strident statement of Gandhi's new exclusivism as he takes up the struggle of civil disobedience in South Africa occurs in his first work, which was published in 1909, and as I said, is titled Hind Swaraj, or Indian Freedom. It sets forth the sharpest polarities between Indian and Western civilizations. Whereas before 1906, Gandhi had urged imitation of the British, now in 1909 he declares, quote, "If India copies England, she will be ruined. One effort is required, and that is to drive out Western civilization. All else will follow." Gandhi proceeds then to exclude everything Western, from law to medicine, from railways to parliamentary democracy. Everything threatens to corrupt India, in his view now, because the tendency of Indian civilization is to elevate the moral being, that of Western civilization is to propagate immorality. The latter, he says, is godless. The former is based on a belief in God. Indian civilization is far superior to the British because the British are capable only of brute force, while India alone knows the secret of soul force. And then, in italics, India has absolutely nothing to learn from anybody else. Now, that is the height of his exclusivism, his separatism. And when we turn to Malcolm X next time, we'll be making the direct comparison between the stages of development in Malcolm's autobiography with the stages of development that are emerging in Gandhi's autobiography. And these stages follow. Malcolm's separatism is as vehement as Gandhi, with one exception, and that is that Malcolm, during his separatist time, tolerated violence, whereas Gandhi never did. There was violence of the spirit everywhere in Hind Swaraj, but not physical violence. Now, Gandhi returned to India from South Africa after having spent 21 years in South Africa, a large part of that time from 1906 to 1914, waging a struggle of civil disobedience against the South African government, an extraordinarily successful struggle because Indians were willing to go to jail in the tens of thousands. When he returned to India in 1915, it was with a method then, after all of this time in South Africa. He had learned to become an astute politician who knew the popular appeal of an exclusivist ideology, and he taught it. Within 4 years, he seized control of the Indian National Congress so that by 1919, the independence movement was growing fast under Gandhi's leadership. The renowned poet of India, Rabindranath Tagore, warned Gandhi that Indian nationalism had taken an ugly turn, that its harsh, anti-Western, xenophobic tone had all but drowned out the inclusivist spirit that Tagore valued most. But Tagore's heedings, he was after all only a poet and not a politician, these warnings went unheeded. Then in 1919 came the Amritsar massacre. This was an event, as one British historian has said, that changed the face of world history. Like the slaughter of the Zulus in 1906, the Amritsar massacre was a single episode of mass violence that revealed the underlying brutality of British rule. Yet the effect of Amritsar on Gandhi was the opposite of the Zulu conflict. Instead of turning him towards exclusiveness, it moved him out of exclusivity and separatism. Now, to appreciate the impact of Amritsar and this key moment of truth in Gandhi's life as he moves from exclusivism to inclusivism, from a vehement separatism to a humanist inclusiveness, to appreciate the impact of Amritsar, we must picture the scene. In March 1919, Gandhi had called on the 390 million people of India to wage a campaign of nonviolent non-cooperation. The response was a mass strike throughout the country along the lines that had been practiced in South Africa successfully. And it effectively challenged the British government in India and its authority. Gandhi demanded nonviolence, but in one region of India, the Punjab, violence broke out and there was rioting, especially in the city of Amritsar. On April 10th, two British officials were killed by a mob, and a British schoolmistress, Agatha Sherwood, was assaulted. This alarmed the government, so it sent into Amritsar the best that it had, General Reginald Dyer, a veteran military leader with a distinguished war record. His task was to restore order through martial law, and when he took command, he prohibited all public meetings and assemblies. What followed was what you may have seen in Richard Attenborough's splendid film on Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi, that is the Amritsar massacre. April 13th, 1919 was a Sunday. It was a big religious holiday in Amritsar. Indians gathered instinctively, peacefully, to celebrate it in the large public square, a walled-in enclosure about the size of a football field. 10,000 Indians crowded into this square on that afternoon. As soon as General Dyer found out about this, he interpreted it as a deliberate defiance of his martial law orders. So he marched 50 of his crack riflemen into the square without giving any warning, fired directly into the crowd, killing by official count 379 Indians. Later, General Dyer would explain his action by saying, quote, "I thought that I should shoot well and shoot strong so that I or anybody else should never have to shoot again." But Dyer did more than just shoot on that occasion. He wanted to set an unforgettable example. So he declared that those who lay wounded in the square, some 1,500 Indians, must not be attended to for 72 hours after. Finally, he passed what he called the crawling order. The crawling order proclaimed that all Indians who happened henceforth to approach that lane in Amritsar where Agatha Sherwood had been attacked, these Indians must get down and, quote, according to his crawling order, wriggle on their bellies like worms to show their repentance for the assault, else they would be flogged to death. The response in India to the massacre was predictable. The government tried a cover-up, first exonerating Dyer, then retiring him only after the public outcry became too much. Indians screamed for revenge, and with the British outnumbered in the country by about 4,000 to 1, they could have got it. That is, the British at no time ever had more than 100,000 Britons there, ruling almost 400 million people. The terrorist movement in India, which was inspired by the Irish in the 1890s, had the most experienced leadership and the most sophisticated organization of any terrorist effort in the world at that time. Its gifted theorists contributed a systematic ideology of exclusivism and separatism to the Indian struggle for independence. And now Dyer's monstrous action gave the Indian terrorists fresh momentum, and they moved to take over the nationalist movement. At this critical juncture, Gandhi moved, too, for an escalation of the conflict, but through nonviolence rather than violence. What allowed Gandhi, rather than the terrorists, to prevail at this point was the new message behind his campaign, a message that marked his breakthrough from exclusivity into inclusivism. Gandhi told India this: "An eye for an eye, and the whole world goes blind." Before this tragedy, he said, we could oppose the British because they victimized us. Now we can see that we are not the only victims of their own system. They are also victims. They have dehumanized themselves. This domination of others that Dyer carried to an extreme afflicts the persecutors with the persecuted, and they have become trapped in their own web of racism. We must not allow ourselves to be trapped too. And we will if we are reduced to hating them. This is a message that, as we'll see, Martin Luther King Jr. literally takes up when he cites Booker Washington in his speech before the Montgomery bus boycott. Above all, do not allow them to drag us so low that we hate them. Gandhi said, if we fight Dyer with Dyer's methods, we become Dyer. If we treat the British as mad dogs and try to hunt them down, denying them their humanity, we end up losing our own. These are the costs, then, of exclusivism. And he begins to use the word exclusivism now for the first time in a pejorative sense. He says we must leave it behind. This is our testing time, when we have been provoked beyond endurance, when the spiral of violence seems unstoppable, and we will stop it. This is the time that it can be broken. And so his plan is to non-cooperate with violence. Not, he says, because we are afraid, but because we have the courage to use restraint and the strength to use non-violence. And so, as the world watched and expected that one bloody massacre would surely be followed by another bloody massacre, Indians defied those expectations. They showed the world a movement that it had no cause to expect because it was so unprecedented, a movement driven not by hate, but by a sense of humanity. Britons joined this movement too, and the test of Gandhi's inclusivism was that he would not just bring Britons into the movement, but put them in a position of authority. Charles Andrews, for example, the Anglican minister who left the church at one point in protest, became Gandhi's closest friend. Madeline Slade, a daughter of an upper-class British admiral, joined the movement and became extraordinarily important as a member of Gandhi's ashram. Reginald Reynolds, a British Quaker, carried Gandhi's letter of protest during the salt march to Lord Irwin and delivered to the viceroy, the shocked viceroy, the word that Britons, upper-class Britons, were also involved in this movement. Many sympathized in England with Gandhi, for they found in Gandhi's inclusivist appeal a common cause of justice, an open hand of trust. It was a British historian, Arnold Toynbee, who said after India gained her independence that Gandhi had achieved as much for England as for India, because by extending that open hand of trust at this critical time, he helped both countries escape a system of violence and domination that had indeed, we can see in retrospect, victimized both. So when the government finally grasped that open hand as it did, Britain and India, in a real sense, Toynbee said, liberated one another. Now, Gandhi's successful use of nonviolence to free India from British imperialism constitutes the main reason why a study of his method may offer some hope for finding, I think, a moral equivalent to war and a way to freedom that does not involve violence. Yet such a study would reveal as many failures as successes, showing that nonviolent action is, at best, a painstaking agent of political change that's constantly in need of creative reinforcement. If the method of mass civil disobedience and non-cooperation proved effective against the British, it was much less successful when used to resolve religious conflict in India between Hindus and Muslims. In the last years of his life, Gandhi threw his entire effort into meeting this religious conflict, yet he failed to prevent the vast civil war that engulfed India from 1946 to 1948, a war that took hundreds of thousands of Hindu and Muslim lives, ending only with the assassination of Gandhi by a Hindu fanatic in January 1948. Even so, while Gandhi ultimately lost his life in the war, he won some key battles along the way. And none was more remarkable than this third moment of truth to which we turn, and that is the Calcutta Fast of 1947. This is the quintessential illustration of his inclusivity. Now, once again, to appreciate the workings of nonviolence, we must picture the scene. Calcutta, in 1946. A large city with a Hindu majority, but a powerful minority of Muslims. There, on August 14th, India's civil war began with pitched battles between the two religious communities, sparked by tensions surrounding the struggle for independence. Over 4,000 people in Calcutta in those 48 hours were butchered in a frenzy of street killing, unprecedented in its scale or intensity, as Hindus killed Muslims, Muslims killed Hindus at a pace that had never been experienced in India before at any time. After that terrible beginning in Calcutta in August 46, fear and fury surged through the city, and for 1 year, Calcutta was divided into two armed camps that came together only to inflict daily violence on one another. Neither police nor military could contain the killing. And into this cauldron, Gandhi came in August 1947 with one purpose: to bring peace to Calcutta. The conflict that he faced was quite unlike that posed by the British. The Muslims were Gandhi's own people, as he judged them, and he was trying to keep them in India rather than to make them leave, as with the British. Yet in another respect, the problem was the same. Just as Gandhi had revealed the system of imperialism at Amritsar to be a burden to both the British and the Indians, so was the continuing religious violence and affliction that all Indians wished to end in order to achieve freedom from fear. Neither imperial domination nor warfare served the needs of most people in this state of continuing insecurity, and Gandhi's method tried to offer an alternative. With that aim, he moved into the home of a Muslim friend in Calcutta, and he began a fast for religious unity. He announced that his fast would cease when quiet came to Calcutta. Now, from the beginning, his effort was to present a clear demonstration of inclusiveness. He lived in a Muslim home, countering the exclusivist attitudes of his own Hindu community. He held prayer meetings regularly, where he would read from the Muslim Quran along with other religious texts and then take counsel with his Muslim friends. At first, at the beginning of the fast, the violence continued. But then, as his condition worsened and the threat to his life increased, he was then 78 years old, the people of Calcutta responded. Students, to their immense credit, began demonstrations at the University of Calcutta. This time in order to cross over the barriers set up by rival communities rather than to enforce them. Although some students were injured, the barricades began to come down. Then business groups, trade unions, the press, and the media took up the call for Hindu-Muslim unity as we see this marvelous sea change in the city's temperament occur. At first cautiously, but then increasingly demanding that the violence stop, citizens of Calcutta understood that they must do this. They must persuade Gandhi to end his fast. Now, the most dramatic moment of the fast came, I think, and this is recorded in Attenborough's film, when a gunda broke into Gandhi's room one evening and ran to where he lay fasting. Gundas were thugs who had grown during this year of violence into huge gangs of seasoned killers. Gandhi had often been told that it was no use fasting against the gundas. The man appeared crazed, and when he rushed in, those around Gandhi tried to restrain him, thinking that he meant harm. I've, in my interviews with people who were there at this time, heard this scene described to me so many times that I imagine in moments that I was there, but I wasn't. The gunda threw a piece of bread on Gandhi's lap and demanded that he eat it to end the fast. Gandhi saw his distress and he simply asked, "Brother, what's wrong?" And the man replied, The Muslims got my little boy. So I found one of theirs. I threw him against the wall. I smashed his head. Only God knows. But I know that I'll go to hell." And the man broke down sobbing, and Gandhi held him. And the two of them together, that scene, crying together for all the children that had been killed in Calcutta and that horrendous civil war and violence during that two-year period. And Gandhi uttered the words that might have been spoken to the city of Calcutta as well. He said, "Brother, I know a way out of hell. Find a child like your own. Adopt him and raise him as your own. But make certain that he is a Muslim, and you must raise him as a Muslim." Well, this was the message of inclusiveness that redeemed Calcutta. While other parts of northern India went up in flames of religious fanaticism, Calcutta remained at peace. And a great British historian, writing on the transfer of power, as it's called, from Britain to India, E.W.R. Lumbee, a person who is, I knew him, a model of rationality, studied the Indian Civil War closely and called Gandhi's Calcutta fast undoubtedly the greatest miracle of modern times. Well, what can we learn from Gandhi, from his life, from his teachings then, from these three moments these identities, these moments of truth that I've selected, I think one lesson above all else, that we in the world have become hooked on violence, and it's time to break the addiction. On the one hand, we view violence with horror when it threatens or it touches our loved ones and ourselves. But on the other hand, we depend on it to solve our problems or to get our kicks, as in the Gulf War when we saw no other solution and then stayed glued to CNN for the best entertainment. Gandhi repeatedly characterized violence as the most potent of all drugs, and he predicted that if we survive and learn in the future, centuries hence we'll look back on this century as the one most under the influence of violence. Drugs like this enslave us as surely as crack and cigarettes. They make us compulsive. They cut off our choices. They make us fearful of how we can possibly survive without them. We don't need this kind of bondage to fear. Gandhi's nonviolence is a creative, forceful exploration of active alternatives to violence. He called it inclusiveness, and it was an attitude of mind that he attained only after a lifetime of experiments and trials. It may not work every time, that's true, but we know that violence doesn't work every time or most times. Nonviolence is worth trying in families and schools and city streets, in our government, even on our TV and movie screens. Gandhi was the first to argue, give peace a chance. And now we see, at a point of time and in a region that has been torn by violence, courageous peace negotiators in Israel trying to do precisely that as we speak. Because they know, as we know, that this is the way to liberation and fear. And I was... for liberation from fear. I was heartened, as you saw too, perhaps, by the New York Times headline Wednesday, September 1st of this year. In Israel, the Israeli people are divided, but are willing to give peace a chance. There are brave people who realize at this moment in their negotiations that they must take a radical step forward to solve this violence that's occurred in the Middle East now for decades. As they do that, they realize that it is in their own interest to achieve this, to achieve freedom from fear and from the kind of daily insecurity. I visited Israel, perhaps you have as well, that people have suffered through for so long. This is a selfish interest as well as an unselfish one. And nonviolence is an appeal to our best interests, our higher interests, but to all our interests, to relieve us from the kind of fear that we have suffered with for so long. Give peace a chance.